Welcome to The Rehab on the Mental Health News Radio Network. I am Dr. Mark Leeds, and I will be your host. Join me in exploring the world of addiction treatment. How can we improve the ways that we help individuals to overcome addiction? The goal of treatment is to save lives and help people to get back on track to a path towards success and happiness in life. Welcome to the Rehab Podcast. My guest today is Orlando Castro, and thank you for joining me.
Absolutely. Thank you for having me on your show.
Now, you work at Larkin Hospital in South Miami, and you are the program director for the adolescent program, and a significant part of your program is addiction treatment. Is that correct?
That is correct. They come in with a primary diagnosis that's not substance abuse. You know, they come in for depression, self-harming behaviors, bipolar, but I want to say about 80% of them have an underlying issue with substance abuse.
Of that group that does have an issue with substance abuse, are you seeing a lot of the kids coming in with opioid use disorder?
Yes, we do. We do have a lot of kids that are using opiates already at an early age, because our unit treats 12 to 17 years old, which is the age group that we treat. And I've already sent, we average one to two kids a month that really need help and really admit and pass the denial period that they are addicted to opiates. And we have sent them to treatment centers. I'm talking about kids that are 15, 16. We sent one last week that's 17 years old due to his opiate use.
Now, is your facility, is it an inpatient facility or is it an outpatient treatment program?
We have a combination, Dr. Leeds. On my specific unit, we treat the inpatient crisis stabilization. So what we do is we treat the crisis immediately, and then we refer out accordingly as needed for what's best for the patient, what type of aftercare, individual therapy, medication management. But we also have a very good PHP, IOP, outpatient for adults that treats, you know, the substance abuse, the opiates, and guys, it's a dual diagnosis treatment center, but we focus with substance abuse disorders.
Yeah, as far as PHP and IOP, I understand that it's different levels
of care.
So where you start, someone might start with residential and then from there step down to PHP, which is, I believe, something like 8 hours a day, 5 days a week, or that might vary.
Correct. Well, yes, sir. Dr. Leeds, what we've been working with, we do send a lot of guys that are in our level of care, which is a less restrictive setting, and then they might not be able to continue in their recovery, so they have to go back or into a treatment center, or we do work with treatment centers that do a step down after 60, 90 days in a treatment center, and then they step them down to our PHP, which is five times a week. And then we even step them down from the PHP to the IOP, intensive outpatient, which is three times a week, sir.
I don't know if you're seeing this yet, but I think we're going to be seeing a trend in the very near future.
Yes, sir.
A trend of more maintenance medication treatment for people with opioid use disorder. Traditionally, the treatment centers have been against it, and they may use medication. You know, they may use it for a short period of time and taper people off. And what we're finding is that evidence shows that long-term maintenance is generally a safer and better way to treat people with opioid use disorder. And it is finally coming to the. I'm hearing more and more of programs that are recommending that.
It is, and little by little, because a lot of the treatment centers are used to the old traditional setting and not the tapering of them with their own medications. But you're right, with the maintenance program, I've already seen maybe two treatment centers up in Broward that started that, you know, that are trying to do just a maintenance program instead of the traditional medication and the traditional, you know, detoxification of the treatment for these opiate use, which the epidemic is just amazing.
Oh,
amazing.
Yeah.
And the addiction is amazing, how when you hear their stories and you hear why they use, and the addiction of it is just an amazing component to when you do therapy with them.
it really is significantly more deadly compared to other forms of addiction. Well, I don't want to say other forms of addiction because addiction is addiction, but there's different kinds of use disorder. There's cocaine use disorder and alcohol. These days, currently, opioid use disorder far surpasses all the others as far as being deadly.
It's very interesting what you said, because it's all about a matter of the changes of time. You know, you in the treatment center that I did my hours in, you do have cocaine use, you have alcohol use, which is a very scary one, because when you go through the withdrawal of alcohol, they could be deadly, you know, if you don't taper it and do the correct detoxification. But now when we started seeing the opiate use, these young men that I work with, and I'm talking about ranges from 21 to 27, we were losing one every 3 months, you know, due to an overdose. And then within a week's time, you had other kids just relapsing because the addiction is so powerful, because the opiates is not just opiates. You don't even know if they're mixed with something else or laced with something else, you know? Yeah. And then that's where the psychotic features comes in, just by one use of an opiate, or the addiction of just being addicted to it, or just having one bad reaction to it, and it may cause your life. Yeah, you know, so the therapeutic component of that is so important, to try to do therapy in working with these individuals and change their addiction behaviors, which is very, very tough, very strong.
That's a scary thing to, you know, to think that kids are starting that young with, you know, with these hard drugs. What are the differences, and how do you treat someone who's an adolescent or a young adult compared to someone who's older coming into a program? Are there any differences?
Well, the difference that I use, at least the style and the form that we use in our center, and when I work, my personal opinion and how I work with them, is the younger kids that I work with, is they're using the marijuana and they're using the Xanax, you know, they're abusing that. And then what happens is that these young kids always have a story. They minimize, well, marijuana's not bad, it makes me feel better. This, I mean, that's all just, they're minimizing of becoming an addict. We don't know if they have it in their genes. We do not know if they have it in their family history, because they're always chasing that high. You know, once they smoke marijuana or they take a pill, it alters their mood. So you're always chasing that mood. Then what happens is, which is the oldest saying in the book, you know, all these drugs are gateways to more harder drugs. And then that's what happened. They're going and they're mixing into the opiate world, you know, and that opiate world is so powerful, and that high that they get, they never could repeat it. So they're always chasing it, you know. And what we try to do is just educate them of where they started, what type of consequences they've had, if any, and what's going on within the family and their lives at the moment that they feel that they need to use that drug. Is it because they like it? Is it because you're masking a pain? Because a lot of these drugs are painkillers, you know?
Yeah.
So, I mean, it's very interesting, the responses that you hear from our youth. And then, I've been doing this for a long time, and you get older, how the world has transpired into these hardcore drugs starting at a very young age.
I'm glad you said that about marijuana being a gateway drug. I mean, recently I felt like I was going crazy. Online, I had gotten involved in some discussions, and I made a comment at one point that, you know, marijuana is a gateway drug. And, you know, the pro-legalization people jumped all over me saying, that's not true, go look it up. And, you know, I feel like everything is being rewritten, because people are so much in favor of legalization that...
Yeah, everybody's going to have their opinion on that, and because I hear that story with my kids. Well, if I move to Denver, it's legal, you know, or if I move to a state that marijuana is legal. But it is the oldest saying, and from my experience, you're going to get both sides of the aisle. You know, the ones know it isn't, ones it is. In my experience, the kids that I've sent to treatment have all started with smoking a marijuana joint, that they were lucky enough that it was just marijuana. Because nowadays you smoke marijuana and you don't know if it's laced with anything. You have no idea what you're smoking or what you're getting yourself into. It does open the doors to other type of drugs due to Ms. Dr. Leeds, because you're always chasing that high or the original high that they got.
And just because marijuana, you know, they say no one's ever died from marijuana, it's not safe
right.
for children. I mean, the children, it affects their brain and their short-term memory. And
absolutely. Absolutely affects the short-term memory. You're talking about neurons. You're talking about kids that are 14 to 17 that their brains are not developed. They're smoking marijuana while their brains are not developed. You know, so yes, in our argument and with our physicians and the way we treat in our substance abuse setting, absolutely it does have an effect on our youth.
Now, there's also there's the issue of nicotine, and there's a thing that I heard about recently at a lecture.
Jury.
Oh, that's it. Yeah, that's a little device, the USB thing.
I just did a show on that, and it was funny because I learned about it maybe 3 months ago, and the kids are smarter than we are. It looks like a flash drive. It's like a little flash drive, and then it comes like in 4 or 5 different flavors. And then the scary part of it, on that specific instrument, Dr. Leeds, on the vapors and the e-cigarettes, yes, you could put THC oil, and the kids were doing that before. But on this particular, on the Juuling, it's like a little cup that's already full of nicotine. You can't open it. So it goes on top of it looks like the flash drive, and then they're doing it in the bathrooms. They are doing it in the classroom. They're getting high instantly because of the nicotine. It's one of those pods has enough nicotine as a cigarette box.
Oh, wow.
Over 200 hits of cigarettes, you know, or puffs of a cigarette. And what they're doing is, if the teacher doesn't know or the people doesn't know, they're catching on to it now. You know, it looks like a flash drive. So you charge it like on a computer. You put the pod of the flavor that you get, and you get all this through the internet, which is the scary part.
Yeah, I mean, now you have to, on top of everything else, we have to watch our kids with that, and you know, just,
with the Juuling.
Yeah, the Juuling. How do you spell that? I guess I could look it up.
It's called J. It's called the instrument itself is J U U L, but the kids call it, hey, are you Juuling? So they add the ing to it.
Oh, okay, yeah, and that's right away. I mean, even if it had nothing in it, it's getting these kids used to drug using behavior.
Exactly. Let's say that has no. Well, nicotine is a drug, and it's one of probably the most addicting drug there is. You know, you're talking about smoking cigarettes. You know, and that was created as a non-combustible, you know, form to weed off people that are, you know, trying to get off cigarettes. But these kids are abusing it and using it to alter their brain and alter them for 5 minutes. They do it in the bathroom. They do the pod that's pure nicotine, and then they go back to the classroom. And it doesn't smell. It doesn't slur your speech. You know, it doesn't give you red eye, which are all the symptoms of what we're trained to look at to see if somebody's under the influence.
Yeah, and what? So what would maybe parents and teachers look for? Like maybe just withdrawal symptoms or behavior changes?
Well, what we're trying to do now is we've been educating in the school system because this is fairly new. I want to say about a year and a half. So we're trying to educate the parents and the teachers and the community and the administrator, even the police, law enforcement involved, of just looking and smelling if you smell something different. Like it could be an ice cream flavor. Could be a fruit flavor. I mean, if you see the kids' reaction within, from the time they went to the bathroom to the time they came back to class, because that's what they're doing it. Or they're doing it in between periods of going from one classroom to another. We work very, at Larkin Hospital, we're very associated with the school system, and we're always trying to promote and educate, you know, just educate. And we're also trying to keep up with everything that's new and coming out.
Now, Larkin Hospital is an educational center. You're training.
It is.
You're training doctors in the field of addiction treatment, also with fellowships and that sort of thing.
We do have a fellowship there mostly. We have so many fellowships, and that autonomy, we have mostly a psychiatric. We have psychiatric residents. We do have neuroscience. We have the dentistry. It is, well, I think it's the third largest teaching hospital in the country.
Oh, that's incredible. I've been recommending doctors in general who are unhappy with the medical establishment as it is. You know, doctors who are unhappy working for large hospital systems and large clinics, you know, when they want to drop out and start their own small clinic, I've been recommending that they consider possibly making addiction treatment an important foundation of their practice. And it's a model that works, that allows them to get started. And it's something they can do that's good for the community and good to help out in fighting this new opioid epidemic. Now, if somebody does start, that someone gets into doing addiction treatment and they really love, you know, that kind of work and they want to take it a step higher, doctors can become certified, board certified in addiction treatment through one of these programs.
Absolutely. Yes, Dr. Lees. And the good thing about Larkin is, and I've been there a year and a half, and every day I learn something new that we have to offer, is that these residents do rotations, you know, so they do inpatient rotation, they do outpatient rotation, which covers substance abuse. Some of them love, you know, when they do the psychiatry round, some of them love psychiatry, some of them don't. Some love working with the adolescent, some of them don't. And in the last 3-4 months, when they do the rotation, because they also do it in the PHP, IOP with substance, they just love the addiction component, you know, because the future coming down as doctors, if you're certified in a specific with substance abuse, it's going to be, you know, there's so many addictions coming down the road and government money that's coming down the pipeline because of the opioid, you know, epidemic that's happening. So the doctors get a chance and explore and see the type of treatment that we do, the group settings that we do, and the individual sessions that we do. So when they hear these guys talk, they have an idea of the underlying of where the addiction process came from. So it's very interesting for these doctors, these up-and-coming doctors that we're lucky and fortunate enough to be working with. And we have a bunch of phenomenal residents and fellows that are wonderful.
And that's a really good point that you make, that not only does the doctor get a chance to learn about the field of addiction and all the various, you know, whether they want to work with children or adults and what area, but also a good point, that great excellent point that you make there is about government funding and maybe
yes,
working with addiction treatment facilities and insurance companies, that you may need to be board certified in addiction to work in certain areas.
Yes, sir. Yes, doctor. And right now, as it is, we work very closely in Miami with South Florida Behavior, which a lot of the funding that comes from the government and the state goes there, because we do have a lot of unfunded clients that need help. You know, and we treat them all the same. A client is a client, and addiction is addiction. So there's already money being, you know, funneled down to them. We use them to get them help, and there's going to be a lot more funding that's going to be coming down for mental health and for addiction, because there's not enough appropriate resources, Dr. Leeds, to help with our clients. And one of the biggest things since I've been at Larkin is that we've tried to incorporate proper aftercare so they don't come back, you know, where the doors are open if you need us, but so you don't come back into our crisis stabilization mode.
So aftercare would that be like stepping down from the different levels of PHP to IOP?
Yes, sir. Okay. That's one component. The other component is getting the right psychiatry if they're in the right medication, if they leave the hospital with medication. And I'm a big believer, my number one believer is getting the appropriate therapeutic process, getting the right therapy that the patient could bond with so they could get a cordon, you know, therapy once a week while they live their life. You know, if they're adults, they go to school, they work, and they go to therapy. Or if they're a child, they go to school, and then they go to therapy after school.
Another thing you bring up as far as getting people started in the hospital, there's several programs around the country. I think it started at Yale, and now there's one in Palm Beach County, and I know of another one in Mississippi, and maybe you're doing this at Larkin, where they're actually starting addiction treatment in the ER when someone shows up with an overdose. You know, rather than telling them, you know, you need to go to a clinic and maybe get started on Suboxone or methadone, or they wouldn't start methadone, but there's actually emergency room doctors in these settings where they can actually start the patient on medical treatment, and then within that hospital system, get them right into the clinic to continue with maintenance and never send them out again, so you don't have to worry about them relapsing again out in the streets.
That's a very good point, because what we started maybe about 8 months ago is we started a new, it's called New Vision Medical Detox, okay? And let's say we do get somebody through the ER that's just like that. It's the same way you just explained, Dr. Lee. We medical clear. We do all the medical clearance in the ER that we have. And if the patient meets criteria under that, you know, opiates, alcohol, or anything that they've taken, then we do what we call a medical detox, medical clearance detox within our own building. So then they go maybe from the ER to the third floor, which is a medical floor. And that's where the New Vision Detox Center is. And then from there, we continue the therapy. Because if you did an overdose or you did something related to substance, and we do the detox, you should always follow up with some type of treatment, either outpatient treatment or inpatient treatment. And that's where we help this brand new service that we have that helps the patient just from point A to point B get the proper level of steps and level of care as long as they want it, because that's the other component. You know, a lot of our users, we have to be ready to be ready. You know what I mean? You have to be tired of being tired and having consequences and being borderline of between life and death, because substances will take your life.
Yeah, and unfortunately with you know, the opioids that are out there, that, you know, people don't always have a chance to reach their bottom and be ready for recovery, because their bottom in many cases is going to be death.
Exactly.
Are you guys involved in the current movement of getting naloxone or Narcan out in the community and making it more available for harm reduction and reversing?
We haven't started that movement yet. We've been in the exploring, you know, we've been talking about it because, you know, I mean, everybody has the Narcan on them and everybody has that, you know, for safety reasons. But we've been addressing and speaking about that at this point, because all the officers are trained with that. The firefighters, you know, they're all carrying that with them, because that at least brings them back with enough time to be able to get them to an ER, you know?
Yeah, and that's something that I was having that discussion with someone recently about the possibility of Narcan even being made as prevalent as things like fire extinguishers and automatic defibrillators.
Yes, sir.
You know, we see these things on the wall, these life-saving devices and equipment, and why not have the Narcan right up on the wall next to it?
That is, I've never heard of it on that format, but it's a wonderful idea and a wonderful concept, because that's exactly when we deal a lot with law enforcement, and they say how many lives they've saved to within 5 to 10 minutes to be able to get that patient or client to the hospital because of the Narcan that they had. So if you're right, if we have that on our wall, in our hospital wall, why can't we? Yeah, that's a very good point that you bring up, Dr. Deep.
And I actually recently spoke to an ER doctor who told me that they had a patient who actually overdosed right in the middle of an NA meeting. They actually fell on the floor, turned blue, and they had to call for 911 to come pick them up.
And I have never seen that. I myself am in recovery. You know, I've been 11 years sober, but I have gone to a lot of it. That's why I take the substance abuse so passionately, you know, and I work with one client at a time, and that is somebody saved my life, so I'm here to try to work and educate it the best I can. And in this component, I've been in AA meetings that people, I've never seen somebody overdose in an AA meeting, but I've seen them drunk, I've seen them passed out, you know, I've seen them, so, you know, they're not there to get the message. They're safe there for 40, 45 minutes, but unfortunately, they're not getting the message at that specific time. Recovery of addiction, any addiction, but with substances, is very, very hard. It's a combination of dealing, like I said, with you know, the mental disorder or the underlying of why they're using it. Most of them are using it because they like the high or the way they make them feel to masquerade something else that we were talking about. And then that addiction process is very, very powerful. Very, very hard to stay in recovery and to stay with your support system to do that.
In your programs that you run at the hospital, do you interface with the 12-step programs in some way with AA and NA?
Absolutely. Yeah, we do the 12 steps for AA and NA. And again, that's mostly focused on our outpatient, PHP-IOP, which we're going to start something very good within the next 2 weeks. We're going to do a PHP-IOP for adolescents. Here in Miami, there isn't many, and we're getting a lot of requests to do that. But we do have the module of the 12 steps. We do the 12 steps forward.
There's no reason why spirituality shouldn't be a part of medical treatment for mental illness.
If you look at the 12 steps program, you could correlate them a lot to just living a good, normal life if you follow the 12 steps. And it's magical because when you go into these 12 steps program, they tell you what is your higher power. Some people could say the doorknob, okay? But in reality, I think you're going to need something more powerful than a doorknob to keep me from injecting myself or from taking an opiate. You know what I mean? So if you follow the process, if you follow your support system, if you follow the 12 steps, you add that beautiful component of spirituality. I've seen magical things happen in recovery and in treatment. Some people believe in it. Some people don't want to go to a center that's faith-based, but I was blessed enough to be able to be a part of one.
I wanted to ask you about, you know, when it comes to treating the adolescents, there's someone that I spoke to recently that is talking about, you know, he has some interest in starting a program, and this is someone who has run a large-scale residential treatment program for adults, and he's talking about starting a program similar for adolescents. What would you recommend from your own experience if finances were not an object and you could start any kind of program you wanted, you know, like whether it be like maybe like a ranch or a fancy high-end treatment center, like what would your ideal thing be for, you know, if money wasn't an object and you can give these kids the best possible treatment, what would your idea for designing that sort of program be?
That's a million-dollar question, Dr. Lees, because I've been asked that question for 15 years, and I've been trying to explore, and there's been funding for it, and I guess, again, here in Miami, there isn't any. My ideal residential treatment center will be, first and foremost, very powerful, strong clinical modalities, okay? Very powerful modalities of the 12-step programs. And then as physical plant-wise, like you say, a ranch setting would be nice. You add ropes course to it. That ropes course is an object that we've used in residential that helps you build trust. You know, it's a ropes course. They live in an area that you could go get schooling, so you don't miss schooling. Let's say you're there 3 months, 6 months, you get schooling within that county. My dream would be to have family therapy, meaning that I bring in the families once a month and we all talk about their experience. My component of having a multi-family group is very powerful because you hear stories from other families and what they've gone through. Because remember, whoever is going through the addiction, they're not going through it alone. You know, you're hurting spouses, you're hurting brothers, you're hurting sisters, you're hurting family members. So it entails everybody.
And that, there's all different situations. That, for example, there was a discussion of the person who was struggling with addiction actually had parents that got her involved with her addiction. And, you know, parents, you know, this person, when she was 13, the parents were giving her drugs and using drugs with her. So there's
not
some really
surprising.
Yeah, really difficult situations out there, you know, when it comes to families.
We deal with that. See, on that specific case, I don't want to say they're giving the drugs by the mom or dad. It has happened, but the kids are stealing their mom and father's drugs. You know what I mean? So they have it available that they steal it from them and they start using it and then they incorporate that. And that's where their career of substance abuse starts. But yes, we have had young kids come into our unit under crisis due to being on blackouts because somebody within your family gave them a drug, and that's all it took was one try or one, you know, one attempt. We have kids that were here in Miami and that are injecting drugs into gummy bears, you know. So imagine you eat a gummy bear and it's full of heroin, it's full of a drug.
Yeah.
So it's very scary. It's very scary things that are out there. We're going to keep up with what's out there. We learn from the kids when they come in, and then we just treat whatever's in front of us and why they're there.
Like what you're saying, where the kids are getting the, you know, the drugs might be provided in different forms. And I know they also have these tablets that might look like manufactured tablets, but they're
yes.
Street drugs. And this
yes,
heroin and fentanyl and carfentanil, these highly toxic substances might be a part of that.
Yeah, and that's what happened here in the Broward in the West Palm Beach area, that heroin was all laced with the fentanyl and all that, and the guys were not making it. You know, all it took was one shot, one injection, and it cost them their lives, you know. And most of these treatment centers are great. They really are good, and then they have the sober living houses, you know. But the addiction is so powerful that they go out and they find it. They can't stay sober. It's hard. Or they don't put the tools that they're learning. You know what I mean? The support system, your sponsor, pick up the phone, call somebody. You know, you could make that choice rather than just picking up.
Yeah.
You know? And that's our strategy. I'm a very reality based. When I do my groups and my individuals, I like for them to think 1,000 of a second right before they pick up or do something, what's going on in their mind, and how can we distract them before they pick up and they use.
Yeah, and it's about changing their habits, I guess, getting them into the habit of going to meetings and making the phone calls.
Correct, because that in itself is work. You know, well, recovery is hard, but can it be done? Absolutely. Going to a meeting is hard. But can it be done? Absolutely, Dr. Leeds. And you really got to go to those meetings when you don't want to go. And you really have to go to those meetings when you're having your worst day, you know, because those group meetings are like medication. You come out of there with a clear mind, because you might not say a word, but you heard something or you heard a message that just changed your mood for that moment. So instead of picking up, you were distracted at that heat of the moment. There's tons of meetings in Spanish, in English, in the morning, in the daytime. There's some that are open 24 hours. There's no excuses not to go to meetings. And usually, not all meetings are for everybody. So that's why it's always good to go to meetings or different ones where you should really feel the most comfortable with. And then on top of that, that's the meeting that you will call your home group. You know what I mean? That's where you will be able to call your home group, you'll be able to present, share your story.
Now, the idea of a home group, that's where you find a meeting, like where you're completely comfortable and you know, maybe you get to know people and maybe find your sponsor there?
Absolutely. You should find your sponsor in a meeting, and it should be in your home group, because that's the meeting that you're usually going to go to every day, or you're doing the 90-90, you know, 90 meetings in 90 days. Your home group is where you should really feel the most comfortable with. And when you're ready, you raise your hand and you say, you know, I'm looking for a sponsor. And, you know, and they're very loving. They're very open, and they want you. It's a very different environment, because a lot of these guys have some short period of time of clean, and some people only have one day, and some people have years of being clean and sober, and they welcome you. It's very loving, and they want you to get help.
From my understanding is that the South Florida, for the people listening who are here, it just has an incredible community of recovery, where you can, you know, like you said, you can find meetings anywhere, anytime of day,
anywhere.
You know, and if you're not comfortable in one, you can easily go to, you could probably go to several a day if you wanted to.
You could. And I know when I first started in my recovery process, you know, I went to a couple meetings, and then later on I found out through others that there's some that are 24 hours, and now I've been doing this for 11 years at least. And every day there's a new meeting that pops up, and, you know, I deal with Spanish speaking clients that say, well, I need a Spanish speaking. There's hundreds of them at all different hours, because you're talking about professionals that are in recovery that go after work. you know, so they go to specific meetings. Even that they have, you know, people that don't want to go just to any other meeting, and they go to specific meetings because they're what they call professional lawyers, attorneys, doctor, pilots, you know.
Yeah, I mean, and addiction can affect anyone. I mean, it's not...
anybody.
Yeah,
it doesn't have a clause. Addiction is... addiction, Dr. Lee, could happen to anybody. It's not a stereotype of what people think of. Some people are less than or no. No, addiction is across the board. And like you say, addiction could be anything. But when it comes to substances, you know, it could affect anybody.
Yeah, and even, you know, like you said, healthcare professionals... and you know, for people in the healthcare field who are struggling with addiction, they don't have to keep it a secret. They can get help themselves, and maybe, you know, once they come out on the other side of getting treatment, maybe they want to get involved in the you know, helping other people get better from addiction, and maybe work in the addiction treatment field.
Which happens very commonly. A lot of people that are working in treatment centers are in recovery, and they're starting on the total, you know, little by little, they're getting their CAP, or they're getting their bachelor's, or they're getting their master's, and they help. In my opinion, they're very powerful because they've been there, done that. So they have a different type of training that is a little bit more tough love. So, yes. It doesn't matter if you're in the healthcare professional and you have an addiction. When you come out through the other side, you're going to be more powerful, more impactful than just a basic therapist, which do phenomenal jobs also. You know, phenomenal therapists. Phenomenal therapists that specify in addictions. You know, they're wonderful. You know, but a lot of the guys that work in treatment centers, a lot of them themselves are in recovery and are trying to help that population.
Yeah, so thank you for joining me today. I'm gonna wrap up the podcast, and I really appreciate you joining me for the show.
Anytime,
today.
Anytime, doctor.
And,
yes,
and like I said, I would definitely like to come on down and see the facility and get together with you and maybe do another follow-up episode, you know, live, and, you know, that would be excellent.
Perfect, and it will be my pleasure, and I really want to thank you for having me on your podcast show. And you, whenever you put this on live or not, just let me know so we could follow it.
Thank you for joining us today on The Rehab on the Mental Health News Radio Network. I hope that you have found this show to be interesting and useful. If so, please subscribe to The Rehab Podcast and share on social media. I appreciate your taking the time to listen to The Rehab.